Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get half gallons of delicious Kroger milk for $1.29 each. Then get flavorful Tyson Natural Boneless Chicken Breasts for $2.49 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaugh, and I am absolutely thrilled to have a different and exciting show for you today. We are going to take a little bit of a detour from talking about clinical anesthesia and critical care and talk about something else that I think is going to be really fascinating. So I'm really pleased to have with me today Dr. Tammy Uliano. And Dr. Uliano, I'm realizing I should have asked you beforehand, but am I pronouncing your last name correctly?
You are. That's perfect.
All right.
Yes.
Perfect. So I have with me Tammy Uliano, who is a professor of anesthesiology and of obstetrics and gynecology. She's an obstetric anesthesiologist at the University of Florida in Gainesville. And we actually are not going to talk about anesthesiology or obstetric anesthesiology today, though I'm sure she has fascinating things to say on that topic, and we might have her back to discuss that. But we're actually going to talk about something else, which is that Dr. Uliano is also a published author. She, in March, published a novel called Fatal Intent, and we're going to talk about that, how she got into the process of writing fiction, what it took to get a manuscript published into an actual published novel, and we're also then going to branch out a little bit and talk about how anesthesiologists are portrayed in popular fiction in general. So, Tammy, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm excited to be here.
So let's start with just a little bit about you. Tell me about your background. How'd you get into anesthesiology in general? How'd you decide on obstetric anesthesiology? And then we'll go from there to how you got into writing.
So I'm a University of Florida lifer from undergrad all the way through, and was going to be an engineer, and then decided I wanted to do medical research. And then somebody told me, oh, to do that, you need to get a doctor, or you need to be an MD. And I said, okay, that's what I'll do then. So sort of a circuitous route, went to medical school, was not a particularly enthusiastic student at the time. Tried to drop out a couple times, actually. And the second time I went to drop out, I met Dave Paulus, who was an anesthesiologist, and he introduced me to Mike Good, who was working on the first anesthesia simulator. So it sort of combined my engineering interest and medical interest and physiology. And so I started spending all my time when I should have been studying, probably, working on the simulator. And that kept me in medical school and convinced me to go into anesthesia. And I really enjoyed that project and continued teaching with it. That was my early career focus, was figuring out how to teach with full-scale patient simulators and running the medical student clerkship. And then J.S. Gravenstein, who some people might remember, he was the first person to start the anesthesia program at University of Florida. He and I collaborated to write Essential Anesthesia from Science to Practice, which is an introductory anesthesia text, really geared toward very beginning residents and medical students. And when we finished writing that, he said, let's do something else. And so he suggested we start a fiction book, which we did. Unfortunately, he fell ill and passed away, but I had the bug then. So I started trying to write a different one and pretty quickly realized I had no idea what I was doing, that just because I could write a medical textbook and research papers didn't mean that I knew anything about writing fiction. So then I started a different journey of learning into how to do that. So I was a residency program director at the time, and that kind of was getting in the way of my new passion. So I resigned that and other administrative duties, and my kids are all graduated. And so I went part-time, and this is what I do on my non-medical days.
Wow. That is absolutely fascinating. So, let me ask you, did you have any background in writing in college, I guess it would be college. Did you ever take a writing seminar or do anything like that?
I never did. I recently found some stories I'd written when I was 6 or 7 years old, but I don't think that counts.
All right. Well, maybe it's in there somewhere, right? Were they any good?
Always, No. I was always an avid reader. And I often, when I would read, would think, oh, that would be fun to write a mystery. You know, the Dan Brown sort of, could you come up with clues for people to try to follow? But I had never really had any training and never sat down and started writing something until this.
Okay. So this must have been a big undertaking. And you mentioned that you had collaborated first, at least on an idea, with a prior colleague. So did he have training that kind of, you know, did you learn from him, or were the two of you learning together?
He wrote stories for his grandkids, and they were beautiful stories, and he would illustrate them, and they were amazing. I don't think he had any formal training. He was German by birth, and English was a second language, but he wrote just beautiful, but they were, you know, kid stories. And he was also widely read. So I don't think either of us really knew what we were getting into.
Sure. But
we didn't get very far. We mostly played with the plot for a few months.
And how did that collaboration come about? Did he approach you and say, hey, let's write a novel, or vice versa? Or how did that happen?
No, it was him. Right as we finished the first book, he said, gosh, this was fun. Let's do something else together. And we talked about writing a book for patients about what to expect from anesthesia. But I looked in Google, and there were several already in existence. And he said, well, then let's write something nobody else can write. And meaning, when you write fiction, any fiction you write is something no one else can write, because it's coming out of your creativity. And we were going to focus on the simulator, because he was part of that project as well, which it was very fun. Someday I'll go back to that story.
Yeah, that sounds fascinating and a fun collaboration. So unfortunately, he passed away, as you said, and you kind of had this idea in your head, though, that this was something that was exciting for you. And so how did you then, did you go through a process of brainstorming different ideas? Did you already have an idea in your head that had been germinating through the process of, you know, kind of thinking about it and talking to him? Take us through that process of how you developed an idea that later became your novel. And was it one of many, or was there this one kernel you had right from the beginning?
This particular book was really the only idea I had at the time, which is a little bit troubling. So the idea was, from childhood, I had been sort of fascinated, oddly, with end-of-life decisions. When I was in grade school was when Karen Ann Quinlan, which is before your time, but it was a woman who was brain dead, and her husband and her parents disagreed on whether to continue her tube feeds. Actually, I may be mixing her up with the other one. But anyway, it was an end of life decision. And should you turn things off? Actually, this was in New Jersey, and the family wanted to disconnect her. And the state of New Jersey said, no, you're not allowed to do that. And she lived for many years on tube feeds. And it was just a horrible situation. And as a 10-year-old, I was part of a debate about what we should do. And I have no idea what I said at the time, but it sort of stimulated a curiosity in me about the fact that there is, you know, when we put our dog down, we just give him a little injection and he's peacefully goes to sleep. And that's not exactly how it works with people. And so during medical school residency, you know, we all face these things in the ICU and watch the families. And so I just had an interest in, not an answer for what it ought to be, but an interest in the different sides of it. And so I knew I wanted to write a story that brought those issues up without choosing a side. And so that's where it started. And of course, I made my character somebody that I could relate to. So she's an anesthesiologist. And I knew enough about the operating room to make it a possibility to design my mercy killer through there. And it kind of went from there. And it was not a straight road. The book was, I probably started 5 or 6 years ago, and it looks very little like the original version, since I had so much to learn about point of view and how to write in characters and drop clues that aren't too obvious, but that are obvious enough, and what level of medical terminology to use, and lots of writing and rewriting and taking classes and hiring people to read it and tell me what to fix, and lots of rejection from different agents. And finally, I actually met a publisher who was a former physician. And she was willing to read it, even though I didn't have an agent. And And so I got really lucky there.
Wow. Okay. And I want to go through some of that in detail because I think this is stuff people don't really know about and it's really interesting. But let me go back because this might be a good time to just kind of give folks, and we don't want to give too much away, obviously, because people probably will want to read this, but what can you give us a little summary of the book for, you know, people who A, you know, might be interested in reading it, and also so we can frame our discussion.
Yeah. So Kate Downey is a young anesthesiologist at a university that is absolutely not University of Florida, but just happens to be located very nearby. She sort of stumbles on the fact that some of her older patients having minor surgery, G-tubes kind of stuff, are passing away afterwards, which when you think about it, we wouldn't necessarily know if somebody died 2 days after you put a G-tube in them. If they go home, it's not something we don't follow up patients 2 days later. Right. And so she discovers this just by serendipity and is curious about it. And the surgeon is less than friendly about it. So he's sort of a mishmash of all the unfriendly surgeons that I worked with, which certainly don't exist anymore, but they used to.
I've never met one, but no. I'll take your word for it. Yeah.
And then her investigation into this is somewhat thwarted by various people who are less than interested in her bringing shame upon her medical center. And so she's helped by some other characters who are just sort of fun, a medical student. And her aunt is actually modeled after my mentor's aunt that he wanted to put in our book. So she's just German woman who mixes up her English idioms, and she's the comic relief of the book for the most part. And so she narrows down this mercy killer for hire scheme. And then she's trying to find this person before he kills more people. And meanwhile, her husband is in a persistent vegetative state from an IED explosion when he was overseas with the military. And so it brings it sort of full circle back to her own situation.
Wow. So sounds fascinating. And I want
to. Thriller sort of Michael Crichton-ish.
Yeah, fantastic. And just for folks who may be wondering, you know, this has gotten quite good press already. And I just want to, we'll put some of this in the show notes, but I just want to read for folks. This is from Lee Child, a quite well-known and incredibly prolific author who's been very successful, who wrote this about your book. He said, "This is terrific, delicious suspense, done that authenticity, and a great main character in Dr. Kate Downey. We want to see more of her." So that's from Lee Child. And, you know, again, there are more kind of really wonderful quotes about it. So clearly, not only have you managed a feat in of itself, which is to get a book published, but you've published a very successful and well-regarded book. So big congratulations on that. I want to go back to some of the process. So you had this kind of general idea. You were interested in end of life. As you said, you had kind of thought about this. You knew you wanted to do something around that. And obviously it made sense to choose a main character who was a anesthesiologist because that's what you do. And so, as you said, you kind of knew that setting and could write that character. Let's talk a little bit more about that main character. Did you, and you may you feel free to decline to answer it, but did you model her? I mean, as you were imagining the story, were you thinking she was you, or was it just a female anesthesiologist, but not necessarily you?
I didn't want her to be me, but they say write what you know when you first start out. And so the more I thought about it, she really was me 20 years ago when I had first started in anesthesia. But over time, she evolved to be quite different from me. In fact, I did my first book club two nights ago, and one of my friends who's known me for 25 years, she said, "I never even pictured you as Kate." Whereas other people go, "Oh yeah, of course I pictured you." So I think she was very much modeled after me, but quickly became smarter and more resilient than I think I could ever be. So I don't think you can help, at least as a beginning author, making your characters a lot like people you know.
Sure.
And yeah, she started out like me, but she's cooler.
Yeah, fair enough. I think that's got to be one of the nice things about writing is that you can make her as cool as you want, right? You can make her the idealized version of you if you want. So
and
she
you
was
do,
modeled
but
in,
then you're
yeah.
Go then ahead. You're told not to. You're told that every character needs to have flaws. If they're too perfect, they're cardboard and nobody wants to get to know them.
Absolutely. And did you ever run into situations where, you know, I could imagine, I mean, let's talk about an extreme. If someone wrote a novel where the main character was a thief or a murderer, that you might have people think, oh my God, you know, is she writing about things that she's done? Right. Obviously wouldn't be, but do you ever have people who you think like look at you differently or who misunderstand you because they're assuming? And again, the book was only recently published, so maybe this is something you might come across, but I just wonder if you think people will, who don't know you well, will assume you are this character and will treat you that way.
This character, it would be great because she's wonderful, but future books, that's worrisome. I go to a meeting every year called Thriller Fest, which is in New York City, and it's all the really famous thriller writers and then all of us fans who go to meet them and hear them talk about their process. And Karen Slaughter, who writes these extremely violent books, is just hilarious. She's one of the funniest people you'll ever meet. And she was interviewing Gillian Flynn, who wrote Gone Girl.
Yeah.
And Gillian said, yeah, I had my mom read it. And she called me and she said, is everything okay? So you're right. People start to go, what is wrong with you that you can come up with these ugly scenarios?
I can totally see that. But at least to start, you've written someone who, if they mistake her for you, that's a good thing. So Right. What about the other characters? Yeah, you mentioned there's a medical student. Did you model that off a medical student who you knew at some point in your career? Or was this kind of like a stereotypical medical student?
Yeah, she's pretty much a mishmash of many medical students that I've mentored and worked with. And I tried to bring in little things like, gee, there's not much exposure to anesthesia. So she originally picks family practice and then she finally does an anesthesia rotation and says, oh my gosh, I love this, right? Which I've seen innumerable times from medical students.
Absolutely.
And her main person who she's working with is a man with, you know, now people are saying, oh, I want them to get together in the next book. And, but she's married in this book, even though her husband's brain dead. And so my husband keeps saying, great, you make me brain dead. And you're going to cheat on me. It's not you. So a lot of the people are modeled after people, but I tried really hard to make them all mishmashes of people. So no one would specifically identify themselves other than certain events that happened. Like my chairman at the time, when that was my career, broke his hip jumping a hose on a skateboard. And I have that event in there. So he knows it's about him, as does all the faculty who were at UF at the time. But other things about him are much more like one of the other chairmen that we had after him. So yeah, they're all combinations.
And with something like that, that's a great example. So this is an actual real life event that will, you know, tie that character to a person that not only you, but others will recognize. When you're going to do that, do you get permission from that person or not? I don't know the ins and outs of that.
Yeah, I had to look that up and ask people about it. And they said, in general, to try to avoid real places where bad things are going to happen. But if they're just going to go to a restaurant, it's fine to use the real restaurant. And the restaurant might even like it because people would go, oh, look, there's that restaurant.
Right.
When it comes to people, if you're not maligning them, then you can use real people without their permission, recognizing that if they feel like you've presented them in a bad light, they could sue you over it. But then they would have to prove that it caused them damages. But I don't want to go there. So I'm just not going to use any real people. Although I got a message on LinkedIn that I had inadvertently used a real person's name who is also a nurse anesthetist. And he was not happy about the fact that I'd used his name. And initially I tried to Google all the names I was going to use, but some of them are just common names and you're going to run across that.
Yeah. So, okay. So you can request, ask permission. Don't have to, as long as it's not kind of maligning someone. All right. And then let's talk about names. I've always thought that would be so hard to come up with a name for a character in a book. Tell us, how did you come up with Kate Downey as a name? And then, you know, just in general, how do you come up with names? Is it the same as naming a baby? Like you look through a book and decide what you like?
I actually bought a baby naming book so that I could pick, and it's got like the most popular names for each decade. So that when I pick a character who's 70 years old, I can go to that decade and pick a name that's appropriate to that decade. Cause you don't want to call them Ryan if they're 75. But I find it extremely difficult. And the other thing that's difficult is you're told not to use names that have the same first sound because readers will get them confused. So then you need a library of all the first sounds of all the character names you've used to make sure you don't have Mr. Smith and Mr. Sorensen and Mr. And I've had to change so many names because of that. So it is not a skill of mine. I tend to, if it's a foreign person or a person with a certain career, just for fun, I'll look up a foreign name for that career, you know, that word translated into a different language. And then if it works, I'll use that. But it is not one of my strengths.
Okay.
Downey happens to be the name of a good friend of mine. And a couple times I used friends. People will ask, oh, please put my name in your book. And they don't care whether it's a good guy or a bad guy. They just want their name in the book. So I'll do that when I can. My brother-in-law wants me to. And I said, I can't really use Giuliano as a character. That won't work.
That's tough.
Interesting. And I wouldn't have thought of it, but I completely agree with what you said about difficulty. You know, if you have like a Kate and a Karen and a, you know, in a book that are in any way similar, it's very hard, at least until you get to know them really well, to differentiate. So that I'd never heard that as a tip, but that makes a lot of sense. All right. So you have this idea, you have this character in your head that's kind of modeled after you as a young anesthesiologist, and you have this interest. Okay. So you've never done any formal training. What did you do? Did you write a first kind of manuscript? And you mentioned you did some classes and stuff, but did you start with like getting a manuscript done and then go to classes? Or did you say, okay, I have this interest, but I don't really know how to make it into a manuscript, so I'm going to take some courses? What was the process?
Well, I started by sitting down and going, cool, I'm going to write a book. And I looked at the blank screen and I typed and I deleted and I typed and I deleted. And I went, I have no idea how to do this. And so I went on Amazon thinking, oh, there's probably 3 or 4 writing books. I'll just get one. Well, there's thousands of writing books. And so I bought one on plotting that had good reviews. And it was very specific about, you know, do this first, figure out what your theme is, figure out who your main characters are. And so I went through that almost completely. And that helped me figure out how to write a plot. And then I started writing and realized that I didn't really understand how point of view worked, about who was telling the story and how they would describe something. And so I would start and stop and, oh, I need to look that up. And it wasn't just Googling it and reading a couple lines. It actually required some reading. So it took a very long time to get the first draft down. And I was very proud of it, and it won an award. And then I
What kind started, of award? Did you enter it in a contest or?
I did a contest at a small writing association contest in Washington. And I was very excited and, oh, great, this is my new career and I'm going to excel at it. And then I pitched to a bunch of agents and they sort of looked at me cross-eyed. Actually, one funny story, I pitched to an agent and I said, so it's about this anesthesiologist and she's in the operating room and she's working with a CRNA. And he goes, what's a CRNA? And I said, oh, it's a nurse anesthetist. We have this model where those don't exist. they do actually, and this is what I do for a living. And he goes, rewrite it and bring it to me when you get rid of that fictitious person. I went, I don't think I want to be part of your prep. Yeah.
That so, is wild.
Yeah, it's very bizarre. But so then I had it in multiple points of view. So each different character talked during their chapter and realized that probably wasn't best for me. So I rewrote the whole thing from just Kate Downey's point of view. And it's amazing how that changes things. You don't think about it, but all of a sudden anything that happens out of her view, she doesn't know anything about. So then you have to figure out how she's going to find out about these things without a boring dialogue where someone's telling her about it. And it's a whole different world. You know, you go into anesthesia, people who don't know anesthesia think, oh gosh, you just put people to sleep and wake them up. No big deal. And then when you get into it, you realize there's thousands of layers underneath all of that. And the same thing happened with writing. I don't know why I thought it would be very simple, but it similarly has tons of layers and it changes the way you read. Once you know a little bit more about the nuts and bolts, all of a sudden reading is a little bit different because you're analyzing how they accomplished what they did.
Yeah. So I want to go back to point of view for a second. I'm digging deep back to high school English, but I'm remembering that maybe your, you know, authors choose between, like you said, having one, as you ended up with, having just one person who's telling the story, and then you have to, you know, things outside their knowledge they don't know about until they hear about them from someone. And then you can have like the omniscient narrator, right, who knows everything. And I always thought, well, that's got to be the easiest because you can just say whatever you want, right? Because the omniscient godlike narrator knows everything. So I guess you have to pick one. And as you said, you started, it sounds like, not quite with that omniscient narrator, but with a different person in each chapter. And then ended up with Kate. And that was, as you said, that was kind of just what felt easiest and most comfortable to you, was having her tell the whole thing?
It was advised to me that, so they talk about deep point of view, which is the person reading it is sort of within the head of the person telling the story. And so you can bring in a lot more emotion, and which I stink at writing, but I'm trying to learn. It's a lot more like they're right there in the scene instead of watching it on television. And I enjoy books written like that. So I thought that was how I wanted to write it. The omniscient point of view is very sort of 19th century kind of thing. And apparently those books don't sell anymore. I mean, classics do, but that's not a way to write now. Everything is in what's called close third person, which is you're always on the shoulder of one or another character, or first person. But then you'll find books that break all the rules and they're multi-million sellers. So it's a lot of ways to skin a cat.
Yeah. So it is, how about dialogue? I always feel like dialogue is one of those things that, you know, you hear discussed and certainly can either be done incredibly well or really poorly. I don't know if that was a challenge for you. And how did you decide what, you know, so let's say something happens outside of Kate's knowledge, right? So she's got to learn about it somehow if the reader is going to know about it. So you could either kind of have, you know, I guess you could either write, Dan said to Kate and then just like write everything that he said, but not without, or you could literally have a conversation that you're writing between Dan and Kate. And I have no idea if Dan's a character in your book. I just made that name up, but but for Kate, right? So did that come naturally to you, or did you have to learn how to write dialogue?
The answer to that question when we come right back. Stay with us.
Hey, folks. Have you heard about Senolytics yet? They're a class of ingredients discovered less than 10 years ago, and they're being called the biggest discovery of our time for promoting healthy aging and enhancing your physical prime. As we age, as you know, everyone accumulates senescent cells in their body. Senescent cells are thought to contribute to symptoms of aging, such as aches and discomfort, slow workout recovery, sluggish mental and physical energy. I don't know about you, but I don't recover anywhere near as fast as I did 20 years ago. Qualia Senolytic from Neurohacker, taken just 2 days a month, can really help. And it has a 100-day money-back guarantee, so if it doesn't work for you, you haven't lost anything. When I started taking it myself, I noticed a definite increase in energy and mood and a faster recovery from workouts. Resist aging at the cellular level. Try Qualia Senolytic. Go to neurohacker.com/ACRAC for up to $100 off and use code ACRAC at checkout for an additional 15% off. That's neurohacker.com/ACRAC for an extra 15% off your purchase. Thanks to Neurohacker for sponsoring today's episode.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get half gallons of delicious Kroger milk for $1.29 each. Then get flavorful Tyson Natural Boneless Chicken Breasts for $2.49 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Okay, we're back and talking about dialogue.
I had to learn somewhat, but dialogue, for some reason, came fairly natural to me. The place I have a challenge is making sure the characters sound different, that their dialogue is, ideally, you wouldn't have to specify who's talking, that you could tell from the way they talk without using slang or things where you have to try and figure out what the words are. And that I find very challenging. I think all my characters sort of sound like Kate, except for Aunt Irm, who doesn't use any contractions. And so that's a little bit easier. But I try to hear their voice in my head and the way they would phrase things. But that's something I'm still learning how to do. But there's exposition, which is just like you said, Dan told her X, Y, and Z, and then there's the dialogue. And I much prefer to put it in dialogue. The problem is you want to not just have a ton of dialogue. You want them doing something while they're talking so that occasionally they can say, you know, and then he cleaned the sink or whatever. But ideally those are called dialogue tags, that they are characterizing the character at the same time. So if he's a surfer, he's, you know, fixing his surfboard while he's talking or whatever. So it's fun to try and come up with those things for them to be doing. And it's just neat that there's so many options and there's nothing scripted and you have to make it up from scratch and you could go any of a million ways. And it's your own world, which is really freeing.
Yeah. And how much of the world of Kate, you know, Kate's world, and it, I get it that it's not like a fantasy novel, so you weren't inventing a new world, but how much of her, you know, environment, her friends, her own personality, though that was modeled after you, and how much of each character did you kind of design beforehand versus it developed as you went? You know, I've heard that some authors will actually write entire backgrounds for each character before they start writing the story. You know, who their parents were, who their great grandparents were, where they were from originally. Not even if they're going to use all that stuff, but just so they have this person who's like a real person to them, who they then can write into their novel. And others, maybe the characters develop as they go. I don't know if you did one of those approaches or what you thought.
I started, because that book I was using said to do that, I started writing a character sketch. It's things like, what color's their hair? Where were they born? How'd they do in school? And I got super bored super fast. So I ended up just sort of starting the book and then going back and characterizing them sort of later. And then when I get stuck, somebody told me to do this, and it works great for me, is I start with just a blank piece of paper and a pen. It's this thing that writes and it has ink in it. And having them write a letter about their life. And it's so fun how crazy things come to mind that in their history, and I have a big whiteboard that I do a mind map of how they relate to these different characters, and I keep erasing it and then wishing I could undelete because I forget that you can't undelete on a whiteboard. So I have a million photographs of my whiteboard over time, but it's eventually they get much more fleshed out, but I don't flesh them out at the very beginning. And I never... Actually, I was talking to this book club and I said, how do you picture Kate? And they were like, well, we picture you. But in the book, I never say what color her hair is. I don't say what kind of clothes she wears other than scrubs and running clothes. So it's I don't like to read descriptions. So I don't tend to write descriptions. And the buildings are probably all very, I picture my hospital, but I hope there is enough there for people to picture the space if they've never been there.
Sure. Interesting. Okay. So, all right. So you bought this book on how to write, you sketched out a plot, you wrote a version of the manuscript, you submitted it to this contest, you won, which was exciting. And then you started looking for an agent. And what does that mean? Do you email out your entire manuscript to like agents that you, like, do you Google book agent? Tell us a little bit about that process. And also, why do you start with an agent? I think most people would think if you have a manuscript, you send it to publishers. So tell us a little bit about that.
So there's kind of three routes to publication. One is you just self-publish. You just figure out how to format it so that Amazon will take it, and you put it on Amazon and you put a price on it and you cross your fingers. And that's self-publishing. And it's a great route, but there's thousands and thousands of books published that way every single day. So it's a very low bar for quality. And so it makes it a lot harder because people are going to be skeptical. And then there are others. There's one where you can pay somebody to publish it for you, but that's pretty frowned upon. And then there's some publishers who will take submissions directly from authors. Those are small presses. And there's a little bit more quality control there because they've got some skin in the game. And then there's the big five. It's down to five now from about 14, 10 years ago, of the major publishers. And they will only take agented manuscripts. So you have to find somebody who loves your work enough to shop it around to those big publishers. And then the bar to get an agent is it's going to have to be a quality work. And so what you do is there's places to find out who the agents are, who rep are interested in the kinds of books you write, whether it's romance or horror or thrillers. And then they each have a different way that you query them, and you send them a letter, a cover letter saying, here's what I've written, here's how long it is, here's my credentials. And then they write you back, maybe, and say, I'm interested, please send me 50 pages, or please send me the whole thing, all done electronically. And then maybe they reply, and all of this takes months and months and months. You know, you get so excited, you send out 50 queries, and 6 weeks later, you've heard back from five of them, and they're all rejections, but all the rest of them are still pending, and you check your email 1,000 times a day, and it's very heartbreaking. And some of them you just never hear from, and some you do, and some you get asked for fulls, and they may or may not read it. So it's a very challenging world, and it's so different. In anesthesia, I felt like if I work hard enough, I can excel. If I work hard enough on my research, eventually something's going to work and I can publish it. And eventually I'll find some journal that's going to publish my article. And it's not that way with writing. You could do all this and never get anybody interested in it. You can self-publish, but, so it's a different environment. And then the other thing you can do is go to these meetings, like I mentioned, Thriller Fest or the one out west, and they'll have agents there, and you actually sit in front of them, and it's like a speed dating thing. You sit there, you pitch your book with like a 1 minute, here's what my book's about, and they ask you some questions, and if they're interested, they'll give you a card that says, please send me 50 pages, and if they're not, then they just say sorry. Mm. And that's a better way because you get to the top of the slush pile because they've already met you. But these writing conferences are not cheap. And I wonder how people who don't have resources from being a otherwise employed can afford to go to them, because they aren't inexpensive.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. So you sent your cover letter with whatever else they wanted to a variety of agents. And any memory of exactly how many? Was it?
Probably close to 50 over the years.
50.
Wow.
Yep. Okay. 50 agents.
And several of them asked for a full for the whole novel. And none of them went from there. They all said, now this was different versions of it. So some said, you know, your writing's not clear enough yet. And I rewrote it. And then, you know, the next pile, some of them said, oh, I really like it, but it's too dark, or it's not what I'm looking for, or nobody wants to read about medical stuff. I got that. I'm like, there's like five television shows all about medical stuff that do incredibly well. How can you say no one wants to read it? And then eventually I was going to one of the big meetings, and they asked if anybody wanted to be a moderator for a panel. And I wrote and said, I would love to moderate a panel on medical issues in fiction. And I got to do it. And then that's where I met this publisher. She was one of the panelists, because she's also written several books. She's a family practitioner.
Gotcha. Okay. So first of all, this reminds me a little of J.K. Rowling's story, which I don't remember the exact details, but I think she sent her, you know, the first manuscript of the first Harry Potter book to at least 25, if not more, publishers, and got rejected by all, clearly all but one.
They all said, nobody wants to read about a wizard. Actually, they told that story at one of our meetings. They said that the guy at Little Brown took it home and asked his 13-year-old to read it. And his 13-year-old said, you have got to publish this. Yep. And then she went from there.
Yes, we all know what happened next. So, okay. So amazingly, 50 agents over time. Nobody went all the way to taking you on. You said you made various revisions. Were they revisions that came from agents saying, you know, giving you specific things to do? Or you mentioned at some point you hired people to help, you know, as editors. Talk a little about that. How did you make revisions? What did you change, and why, and who was helping you?
The vast majority of things you get from agents is a form letter that says, this is not what I want. This is very subjective. Keep trying. Good luck. They're not at all specific to you.
Yeah, so that's not helpful.
No, occasionally you'll get one that says, you know, I really like your character, but I didn't like this. But for the most part, you can go on different websites and find what's called beta readers. So these are people that just read books, and then they write sort of a report where they say, I really like this, I didn't like that, I got lost here. They're all of different quality. I paid them. Yeah. So for my book's about 80,000 words, and for $100, $200, you can get somebody to read it and give you a 15-page review of what they think about your book. So it's very cost effective. And so if you get three of them and two of them have the same complaint, you can go, oh, I need to fix that.
Yeah.
Very often you'll have three of them with three different opinions about the same sentence, and that's a little more challenging.
Yeah. 80,000 words is about book. Sorry, 80,000 words is about how many pages?
About 300 pages.
300. Okay. All right. Sorry, what were you saying?
150 words a page, about Fatal Intent's 321 pages. Yeah, romance books are shorter and fantasy books are longer. And these are all things you have to learn. What's my target? How long should this book be? So mostly it was beta readers, and then also people get critique partners. So you get another writer who preferably is about at your same level, and you each exchange chapters and tell each other what you like and what you don't like. I haven't been as fortunate in that way of finding compatible critique partners, but that the beta readers have been very, very helpful. And then I also, for a different novel that I've written, hired an editor, which is not inexpensive. And she gave me ideas to go back and fix this novel. And I think it's an infinitely better book than it was 5 years ago.
Sure.
And I think I know more about writing, but as I write the sequel, it's similarly challenging, going through it, but it's still fun.
I imagine. So, okay. You serendipitously, you're on this panel and you meet this publisher, and she's interested in the book. So she takes it, reads it, and says, I want to publish it, or, you know, what's that process?
She did. Okay. I sent it to her, and she wrote me an email and said, we love it. We'd like to work with you. When we set up a phone call, it was actually 2 days after I got my knee replaced. I was on the phone with this publisher, and being a smaller press, they don't have an army of editors and things. And so it was pretty much the book I submitted. There were a few changes that they wanted. It was very minimal. Whereas if you go with a big house, they're going to have you rewrite, from what I hear, depending on who you are, and somebody junior like me, they would probably want me to rewrite 20% of the book. Mm. Which would be challenging because it's your baby and you may disagree with what they want you to fix. And then that was in January of 2020. And it was March of 2021 when it was published. So that's from a publisher.
So what happened in there?
Well, they only publish one or two books a month. And so that was just the next opening for their publication. But it does take months. So for getting the cover, you know, they hired an artist and he came up with a cover and I didn't like it. And then they redid it. And that took a couple of months. And then I had to solicit the blurbs, those phrases on the back cover from authors that I'd met. And that took months because you've got to email them. They've got to agree to do it. Then you have to wait until what's called the ARC, the advanced reader copy. So they publish a paperback of the book that's not been fully line edited, sent out well in advance so that reviewers can read it and start reviewing it. And so those went out in May, and then the cover was finished in November. So they had to have the blurbs back by November in order for them to get on the cover. And then publicity, I mean, there's this whole business. They send those books out to hundreds of people around the country so that they'll read it and write a review that will be available by launch day. So that it can get early press. And then it's really fascinating how much there is to it. And I don't know how somebody who self-publishes, you know, they don't have access to all these bookstagrammers, which I'd never heard of. People on Instagram who just say, hey, I read this great book.
I would never could have imagined all this that you are talking about. Okay. Huge, huge amount that goes into it. How about the title? Was that your original title or did that undergo changes?
That's a funny story. I called it Do No Harm. I thought that was an awesome title. That title came to me very early in the process. Mm. And I called it Do No Harm. Every one of my files is DNH version 72.
Yeah.
One of the first things they said at our first meeting with the publisher was that title won't work. And I said, why? And they said, because there's 12 books named Do No Harm and there's a movie called Do No Harm. And no. And so they said, think about it and get back to us. And And I ended up just writing down, I went through bunches of books and wrote down words from their titles. And then I made a sheet with one word on one sheet and another word on another sheet. And then I slid them next to each other, putting the words together. And we came up with about 10 that way. And Fatal Intent was one of them. And then that was my favorite. And they thankfully agreed to it. But I had to prove to them that it wasn't the name of multiple other books. There actually are three or four other books, but there's a finite number of words you can use.
That's right. There's only so many words. I like Do No Harm, but I get that if there's a lot of other ones named that. Okay, interesting. So you ended up with the title and then this whole process. And then in March, it actually came out. And what does that look like? Does coming out mean that it is in bookstores, available on Amazon, all of the above?
All of the above, yeah. So it shows up on Amazon for pre-orders 2 or 3 months beforehand. And the publisher decides how it's going to launch, and they set the price point. And so they said it's going to come out in hardcover and ebook and audiobook. And so those all came out. And now the paperback doesn't come out for a whole nother year. Mm-hmm. And then they had submitted it to some things. And so we were fortunate to get picked by it's called BookBub, which is just a group that sends out book deals. They chose it for a book deal. And so that really helped because if you get a BookBub deal, you have to sell it for $1.99. So it helps a lot when you're a brand new author for people to go, oh, it's only $2. Oh, yeah. I'm willing to shell out $2, but not $27. Right. And so it was a lot of, the day it launches, you know, you're supposed to be going on book tours, but of course with COVID, there's no book tours, which is probably good because I'm not sure I would really thrive in that environment. And so I did a virtual launch where people were on Zoom and it was done at a bookstore. And we just talked about how, sort of like this, how I wrote the book. But otherwise, now that it's been out a month, it's sort of calming down. I've got a few other podcasts to do and a few. They do these interviews, blog interviews, where they just send you questions and you type out your answers and then they post it. And it always seems like I had a conversation with so-and-so. No, you didn't. You sent me questions.
Right. Interesting. Okay. So now the audiobook I'm curious about, I listen to a lot of audiobooks, love them, is... did you read it yourself? And if not, did you have any say over who the reader was?
So it's really interesting. In the original contract, they said, we will decide whether to do an audiobook. And when I had it reviewed by an attorney, I told him an audiobook's really important to me because that's how I get the most of my reading done.
Yeah.
And so we added a phrase that said, if you don't do an audiobook within 18 months, I get to do it. And it wasn't going to be me. I was going to hire someone to do it.
Sure.
And so... after it had been out for a month and the audio, I emailed them and said, you know, what's the status of the audiobook? And they said, oh, it's almost done. It's like, what?
Whoa.
I assumed I would have a voice. I had already started paying attention to who read the books I was reading to see who I wanted. And they'd already hired somebody and done the whole thing. So it's good. It's very good. I've only listened to snippets of it, but my husband doesn't read it all. And he listened to it and he liked it. So, no, I didn't have any voice in that. And interestingly, I listened to some podcasts about how to do audiobooks, and they say that that's not uncommon, that the author has no say, and that if you have like weird names, they might mispronounce them and you can't fix it, which would be very sad. Fortunately, none of mine are super bizarre names, but I'm curious whether she got propofol and those kinds of things pronounced right. One of these days I have to listen to it.
Yeah, interesting. That is so interesting. And I would think, you know, I bet that if you, as I'm sure you will, become a famous author and millions of copies sold, at some point they'll say to you, you get to decide, right? Like when Malcolm Gladwell reads his own, or when, you know, Michelle Obama reads her own, I think they got to make that decision.
Yeah. Nonfiction, very often the author reads it themselves. And for the audiobooks, some of them are just like they've got sound effects and all sorts of stuff. Mine doesn't have that. And in a series, you tend to want the same voice for the whole series, especially if they do voices for the characters. I don't know if you ever listened to Harry Potter audiobooks, but they're amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. When they do those, you know, voices, same with the Game of Thrones books. I listen to those on audiobook, and whoever, I don't know who the reader was, but the voices were fantastic.
Yeah, especially when they've got like foreign voices, which I struggle to pronounce the French words. Like I listen to Louise Penny, who writes these things sent in Quebec. And it's just, I would love to have that kind of voice. I'd love to have that voice, but I'd love to have that voice read my book.
Totally. Well, that is fantastic. Okay, so the book is out. It's called Fatal Intent, as we just heard, available on Amazon, at your local bookstore, and sounds fantastic. I will definitely be listening to it. I'll be looking for the audiobook, and I'm really looking forward to it. Let's talk briefly about, we talked about kind of how you decided to portray your anesthesiologist character, which was really modeled after you, and clearly you know a lot about that character, both from yourself and just being around anesthesiologists. Tell me a little bit about your understanding, what you've learned about how anesthesiologists are portrayed in general in popular culture and in fiction in particular.
Not well. I remember I was still in residency, I think, and I was watching ER. ER had just started. This is how old I am. And somebody was in labor in the ER, and the only thing they had for an anesthesiologist was somebody with a very foreign accent saying, "I'm here to place your epidural." And that's it. Later, she needs general anesthesia. It's done by the ER staff. Everything is done by the ER staff. There's a few, like apparently the very early MASH movie had an anesthesiologist in it with some role that wasn't negative. And there's a few books like Carol Casella, who's a pediatric anesthesiologist out in Washington, wrote a really great book called Oxygen, which is focused on an anesthesiologist who's in the aftermath of a drug error that hurts a child. And mostly it's about her turmoil, but it does portray what we do as an important part of the medical community. But a lot of people might have seen the Grey's Anatomy, where the anesthesiologist, I think there's a patient with a bomb in his belly or something, and the anesthesiologist is there handbagging them for reasons that escape me. And he hands off to a nurse and says, "I've got kids, I'm leaving." And after that, the ASA had a nice statement about, yeah, that would never happen.
Yeah.
But I think even our colleagues don't really understand what we do. I think most of them know that when they get into trouble, they want us there, but they don't necessarily understand what we do. And I hope that we try really hard. I think my OB colleagues understand because I go to rounds and I point out, here's some issues that we need to think about. And when you get in private practice, you need to let your anesthesiologist know that this person has scar tissue or whatever. But even so, the public still is a little bit mystified by the whole thing because we're not incredibly visible. We greet them at the beginning and pretty quickly give them Versed, and we see them afterwards and they vaguely remember that we were involved, but they don't really know what we're doing. So I think it's nice to have an anesthesiologist in a positive light. I didn't want to preach, but I wanted to throw in some of the things that we think about. And I mentioned that we talked to the attending the night before for a period of time about the cases, planning ahead, and people who have reviewed the book have said, "Oh my gosh, I had no idea that they actually talked about me the night before." So sprinkling in those sorts of things, I think, is fun.
And then yeah, I love that.
As a device, I used my medical student, which I do in real life as well, so that I can teach at a junior level, using terminology I would never use doctor to doctor, but I right. would use to a medical student to try to bring out things. Because to use those words, if I were conversing with a physician, would be contrived, and any physician reading it would go, "What? They would never talk like that."
Right, right. No, I love that. What a neat way to do it. And I'm glad that you are trying to put out some accurate information about what we do. It is funny. I mean, I remember a patient one time when I told them that I would be, you know, getting them off to sleep and taking close care of them while they were asleep and then waking them up at the end. They said, I didn't realize you stay the whole time and then wake me up. I thought you just put me to sleep and then leave." you know, which is just astounding for us. But, you know, if this is how it's portrayed in TV, then why would they think anything else? So I'm glad we'll have an accurate representation out there. Thank you for doing that.
I was, when I was a medical student, I was on my anesthesia rotation and I was working with a colleague, and we went into a room and he was explaining the anesthesia, and she said, what does it take to do what you do? And he said, well, you know, after high school, you do 4 years of college, 4 years of medical school, 4 years of residency. And she goes, oh, you could be a doctor. And he went, well, in fact, I am.
That is great. Yep. That's about right. All right. Well, Tammy, this has been fantastic. Anything else you want to add before we move to our random recommendations segment?
The only thing is, even though we are all doctors and theoretically knowledgeable about end of life issues, if you have not yet got a living will and your family members don't have living wills, I strongly encourage you to do that. We all see these things, but we never really think it can happen to us. And I highly recommend that everybody have that conversation with your parents and your loved ones and make sure you understand what they want and that they understand what you want.
Yeah, absolutely. Fantastic. Great advice. I give the same to everybody. And I think it's crucial to do that. Well, Tammy, thank you so much. Let's turn to the portion of our show where we make random recommendations. What do you have to recommend to the audience other than, of course, your book, which I think we all can agree people should check out?
I would love that. So my first one is a movie that I think everyone should watch. It's not highly popular, but you can find it. I think it's on Netflix. It's called The Ultimate Gift. And it's got some stars in it. And of course, I can't name any of them, but it's about a young man who was a child of privilege who had some bad things happen to him and is now living sort of a hedonist life. And his grandfather posthumously guides him back to recognizing what's important in life. And it is just a phenomenal movie that everybody should watch with their kids, maybe not with super little kids. But I think it will sort of reset your focus of priorities. And then two books. One is called Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. The first half of it is about his experience in Auschwitz. He was a physician who ended up as a prisoner in Auschwitz, but then he developed something called logotherapy, which is he went back to school and became a psychiatrist. And it's about finding meaning in life. And I reread the second half of it every couple of years because it's just a really great view of how to keep your life on track. You can see I have a theme here. And the other book that I just read, it just came out, is called Think Again by Adam Grant. And it is about, he's a social scientist, something like that, at an Ivy League school. And he's done a bunch of research on how we make decisions and how we think about things and how we keep our minds open to changing our opinions when the facts come to light that are different than what we thought they were. And especially in the current climate, I think it's a very important book for everybody to read. I wish we could make it sort of required reading because it really is good about not being so set in your opinions that you're not willing to listen to opposing views.
Love it. That sounds fantastic. Definitely we'll check those out. Thank you. I'm going to shout out a new podcast by Anesthesiology News. Yeah, people may remember they've done a podcast now for a few years called The Etherist, but this is a new one they call Ask the Experts, and it's very cool. Actually, they've taken anesthesiologists from around the country who are well known for one thing or another and interviewed them and just kind of asked for audience questions beforehand. And so done a bunch of interesting question and answer with these anesthesiologists from around the country. There's a recent episode that I'm going to specifically recommend with Amy Pearson, who's a wonderful anesthesiologist who was very involved as the president of the Women in Anesthesiology group and is still very involved. And so a lot of the questions have to do with kind of busting some of the myths of why there's a pay gap and, you know, what we should be doing to help foster and support our women in anesthesiology. So I think it's really well done. Amy does a fantastic job, and the podcast in general, I think, is great. So check that out. Anesthesiology News, Ask the Experts, and we'll put a link in the show notes to the three ones that you recommended, Tammy, and to that as well. Well, this has just been fantastic. Thank you so much. I hope the book is a huge success. I'm sure it will be. I look forward to reading it or listening to it, and wish you all the best.
Good. Thank you very much. And keep doing what you're doing. Our residents love it.
Awesome. Thanks, Tammy.
All right. That was awesome. I just thought that was so interesting and so impressive that she was able to get this book published and be an anesthesiologist all at the same time. If you have comments, go to the website, acrac.com. Tell us what you thought. If you have written a book of your own, let us know. Put the link in the show notes. If you're a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, you can go to patreon.com/acrac. You can go to Venmo and look for Jay Wolpaw. You can go to paypal.me/acrac, and you can do that in any way that you'd like. We really appreciate, obviously, any donations that you make. Thank you so much to those who are already patrons and have already made donations. You can find us on Twitter. We're at ACRAC Podcast, and I'm at Jay Wolpaw. You can also find us on Facebook at the ACRAC Facebook page. Thanks so much to everyone who has been part of those conversations. Huge thanks, as always, to Dr. Brian Park, who is our tech lead, to April Liu, who is our social media manager, and to Dr. Kimia Kashkuli, who helps out with the show. They are a fantastic team. Our original ACRAC music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right, that is it for today. For the ACRAC Podcast and Dr. Tammy Uliano, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get half gallons of delicious Kroger milk for $1.29 each. Then get flavorful Tyson Natural Boneless Chicken Breasts for $2.49 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.